And it's my great pleasure to introduce Arlie Hochschild in the second of three presentations that she's going to be giving during her time here, sponsored by the Haven Center. Before I read a formal introduction and list of Arlie's accomplishments, I want to add a personal note of one of the more significant accomplishments I think she's had, which was bringing me into sociology when I was an undergraduate and convincing me to go to graduate school, for which I am eternally grateful. So what I wanted to do by way of introduction was to read something that was written when Arlie won one of her many ASA awards. She has won the award for the public understanding of sociology, but also the Jesse Bernard Award, which is an award for feminist sociology. So this was part of this. What I'm going to tell you is part of the write-up that she got from her Jesse Bernard Award. Arlie Russell Hochschild is one of the most imaginative and productive feminist sociologists of the last 30 years. Through her commitment to scholarship on women and gender, her extensive publications, and her mentoring of graduate students, Arlie has had an enormous impact on the fields of sociology of gender, the sociology of family, and other key areas of contemporary life. As a scholar, Arlie Hochschild has been at the forefront of research on contemporary work and family life for over 30 years. The intellectual threads running through all of Arlie's work are her use of gender as a category of analysis, her focus on emotion as a sociological topic of investigation, and her concerns about the role of women in society. Her 1973 article, A Review of Sex Role Research, published in the American Journal of Sociology, helped to focus the attention of sociologists on the study of gender. In 1975, Hochschild published her now classic article, Inside the Clockwork of Male Careers, and helped to usher in a wave of research that would take as its problematic the intricate dynamics of the gender division of labor at home and in the workplace. The second shift still stands as the central sociological work on the paradoxes and emotionally complex inequities of the gender division of labor in the home and in the family. The time bind moved the discussion into sites of paid work, probing the speed-ups of contemporary work and family. Hochschild's co-edited book, Global Woman, with Barbara Ehrenreich, has called attention to the global commodification of and inequities in care work. Arlie Hochschild is also widely recognized as one of the founders of the sociology of emotions as a subfield. Her book, The Managed Heart, remains a foundational source, and concepts like emotion work and feeling rules have traveled into the work of many other scholars. Hochschild's work also exemplifies the ideals of an engaged, informed, and feminist public sociology. Her work has had significant influence outside of the academy, making her a public sociologist. The Managed Heart and The Second Shift were both named notable social science books of the year by New York Times. The Second Shift, one of the books listed in Herbert Gann's study of bestsellers by sociologists, reached far beyond the academic and student readers to contribute to the wider public discourse on the gendered nature of work and family. Not only through her own writings, but also as a teacher, Arlie Hochschild has done a great deal to further the intellectual life and careers of others. Her students speak of the long hours she has devoted to mentoring and guiding them. Many of the PhD dissertations Arlie has directed have become books, and many of the critically recognized books in the field have been written by scholars who were directly influenced by Arlie Hochschild. She influenced students and others to see the world not only through the lens of gender, but also with close attention to the dynamics of capitalism and social class, the distortions of racism and racialization, and variations relating to culture and nation. So with that, I give you Arlie Hochschild.
Wow. Hard to live up to.
Thank you.
today, like yesterday, I'm going to take a relational perspective to the marketplace. And but this time, talk about a two-way traffic in care work, client to care worker in the South and care worker from the South going to the global North. And if I were to put it in a capsule, I might be talking about the familization of the global North and the factoryization of the global South. But let's begin at the beginning. For the last century or so, migration studies have been dominated, as many of you know, by a kind of a male-centered paradigm and an economics-centered paradigm. The archetype might be a male Turkish street sweeper in Amsterdam or a male Mexican carpenter in San Francisco. At the risk of oversimplification, this paradigm might focus on the Turkish man's economic role as a wage earner, not his domestic role as father or son, caretaker. There is no care and no emotion in this picture of the male provider. His boss is a man. The boss's boss is a man. He gets his brother a job. And it's a male, often an agricultural or industrial worker that we have in mind here. And the work that man in this paradigm does is physical labor or mental labor. It's not prototypically what I would call emotional labor, the labor of focusing on emotion, managing one's own emotion to evoke or suppress a feeling in the course of doing one's work. So the costs of the male's economic labor is calculated often in economic terms. Is he paid too much or too little? And on the physical costs. And if one were to look at the psychological side in this classic paradigm, one would look at his cultural estrangement. For example, he may be an invisible worker, a gardener in an upper middle class suburb, trimming trees in the first world, but he might be the assistant mayor of a small village, much honored for his remittances back in Mexico. It's kind of a left and a right wing version of that paradigm. Right wing one would be focusing on his free choices and his movement through a free market system. The left wing version would be to focus on his economic rights and equity and economic equity. So the story might, in this paradigm, kind of end there. And this male-centered paradigm of migration is not wrong. Half of the world's 200 million migrants yearly are men. But that's the point, only half. And the other half are women. So we need to kind of tell us and learn about, open up for investigation, what's going on with that other half. Some women move for purposes of family reunification. In other words, they join a male worker in the global north. But the main story that we're seeing today is that more and more migrants, Castles tells us in the age of migration, are women. more women migrate for work than before. Those who migrate for work more often migrate alone. And many of those who migrate, we don't have hard numbers on this, and estimates vary, but something like half of such women are mothers who leave children behind. Many of these mothers take caregiving positions in creches, in daycare centers, as nannies and caregivers of children, in nursing homes and Alzheimer's units, in hospitals as aides. So the paradox is that many of them are leaving their children and their elderly behind in the Philippines or Sri Lanka and coming to take care of our elderly and our children in the first world. I've called it in my essay, Love and Gold, in Global Woman, a heart transplant. My editor hated that term. She said, oh, it's so ghoulish. No, she kept deleting it. I guess, no, keep it in. It says it very, I think, poignantly. More women than men stay in the global north. That is, both men and women go for work, but actually more women want to stay in the United States, for example, and more men, third world, want to go back to Mexico and the Philippines. So that's a kind of a paradox added to this. And much of the what this does, I also argue, is set up a care chain so that the caregiver in the Philippines, we'll come to a case here, might leave her children in the care of her mother. That would be her first choice. If she's married with her husband, often she hires a child care worker to help the mother, and that child care worker often comes from a smaller village. So people that travel are actually not people from the very smallest and poorest villages, but a little bit further up the class. And she leaves her children behind with a caregiver who leaves her children behind either with an elder daughter to take care of or again with a kinswoman if possible. Last option is with an orphanage. This does happen, and I very much recommend to you to see When Mother Comes Home for Christmas, which is an extraordinary film about children who are left in an orphanage by a Sri Lankan caregiver who works taking care of a Greek little girl in Athens. Vaichani is the name of the producer of that extraordinary film. So, that's another thing. This part of this care chain. Now, a few caveats here about this new paradigm we're looking at. One is that this isn't new. We've seen wet nurses come from North Africa to Egypt, for example, and move from small villages to cities and caregivers. This isn't new. This is a new version of something old. But what is new is that more women seem to be involved, number one, and the distances are greater, number two. So what's also new here is that there's a kind of a neoliberal ideology which says about this flow of workers that gosh, this is all a win-win story. Poor people need money, people in rich countries need care. So the needs on one party are met, the needs of the other party are met, it's win-win. And if we just open up the free market, then good will come out of it. So that might be where that story ends. All right, now let us let's see if this works. Oh yeah, here we go. All right. So now what I'm wanting to do is to develop this second paradigm. Look at the questions.
Do you want it all full screen? We just...
Oh, yeah.
It's too close here.
Well, it's full.
F5 should make it full screen, unless there's something wrong with the...
Just go to slideshow.
Okay. We'll edit this out of it.
It's all right. It's full screen for them, yeah.
Slideshow from the beginning.
Now there's something. There we go.
Ah, right.
There's the next one. Okay.
So what I'm going to do to develop this this new subject, point of focus and perspective, is look at a two-way traffic in emotional labor, and to offer you an example of a worker on each pathway, of the pathway going from the global south, in this case the Philippines, to the north, in this case to Hong Kong, and then a second case of a person from the global north, that is a couple that I interviewed, that as medical tourists went to India and seeking the work of a commercial surrogate. Some of you may have heard that. We talked a little bit about that yesterday. Talk more about it today. So we'll get a worker on each side. And compare the kind of what I call emotional labor that each worker does. The one to attach herself to a child and the other to detach herself from a child. All right. So this is a story of a Filipina nanny who left her children in the Philippines. And you should know that one out of four children in the Philippines has a migrant parent. And that this is really a diasporic culture. And that migration has become, in the eyes of the government and even the culture, a kind of an economic strategy. Instead of forming ways of providing jobs in the Philippines, this has become a national economic strategy. Okay, so here is women. They're vast. This is Sunday, the day off, and here all the Filipinas are gathering in a special place in Hong Kong, the airport, actually, and they gather by village so that they can meet with other villagers. So here's a caregiver moving to the client. And here is a woman. You don't have to read this. I just want you to take in the images. And it's a... her name is Josie, and she's taking care of this little girl. Here she is. She's arriving in Hong Kong. some pictures that she has of her family at home. And she's saying here that she used to be married but separated. Actually, the Filipina migration is called the Filipina divorce. So it's very common that a woman is separating for her husband. It's a Catholic culture where you're not allowed to get divorced, and so this is one way actually to do that. But that makes a sad story. The wonderful work by Rossell Piranis points out for the children, because when the wife leaves, if the partners are not together, often instead of doing more for his children, the father of those children moves to another village and sets up with another woman, often starts another family, and so such children don't have their mother, but they also don't have their father, so they turn to their grandmother or another figure. Okay. Now, a real relationship develops between this caregiver and the child she cares for. They have fun together and play together. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, this woman is sending money home. Let me just pause on this story. Don't let me go back. Only forward. Remember the picture of the man in front. Because this is a complicated story. I interviewed a number of Filipina nannies in California, in Redwood City, to the south of San Francisco, and heard an extraordinary array of poignant stories. But what you find is often that they had difficult childhoods, and leave for the United States. I won't totally repeat myself from yesterday. And their employers will say, "Oh, isn't it wonderful? We're getting this Filipina sort of family values, community values, and we're that's what we're buying when we pay for her labor." And yet, what many Filipinas that I interviewed said, "Look, we do love the children we take care of, actually more than our own in a certain way. We have more fun with them. We're more relaxed with them. We're sending our remittances every penny back to our own children and our mother, but for expressive love, yeah, this is actually, that wasn't just a pose, she's really having fun, she's really feeling connected." And often the parents, the clients will say, "Oh, isn't this wonderful? She's bringing to us what she had at home." Whereas in fact, it's a very made in America story, where her leisure, the money she is paid now in America or in the Hong Kong where she's taking care of her child, and the ideology of expressive love that she's learning from Oprah Winfrey and Dr. Phil. Oh, you mm-hmm. get to kiss each other and you get to talk to each other and say, "I love you." And all of that is put together, ideology and these conditions, her together with her own loneliness for her own children, exaggerate and in a sense produce the conditions of that love. Actually, in one interview that I did with a Filipina nanny, she said, "You know, I never kissed or hugged my mother, and she never kissed or hugged me. She never told me, I love you. But I saw it on Oprah, and I tried it with my daughter that I haven't seen in 2 years, and I call her every week. And I didn't know how to do it. And so I just tried it out. And I said, 'I love you.' And she said, 'But I sounded phony.' sounded fake, and I felt embarrassed afterwards, and I was sorry I said it. But then the next time I called her, I tried it again. I love you. A little more, right? And my daughter said, thank you for saying that. And she tells this poignant story of how from conversation to conversation it got real until her daughter was saying it back and it didn't feel borrowed, a little piece of culture, but it was something she badly wanted to hear from this daughter from whom she was separated. So it wasn't an import. It was learned on site. So there's sending money home in other areas of her life. There's making friends with other Filipinas. This is a picture of her at church, and one of the most telling, I think, things, and I heard this in my interviews too. It's, quote, people in the Philippines are quite spiritual, but in Hong Kong they're more business-oriented. Religion itself is a business here, and I think people sometimes take advantage of us for that. And so here the idea is that she feels that her own motivation in loving the child, which has a spiritual component, is received by the client to say, oh, we don't have to really pay them that well. You know, there's a spiritual reward. So she doesn't feel recognized for her own emotional perspective on this care. So she says right here, I see myself here for a long time. If my kids want to go to university, I'll be here for another 10 years. So here again is a long-term perspective. This I got from a photographer. This is on a street, a thoroughfare in Hong Kong, and they've made a cardboard room on the street for nannies to talk to one another, take their shoes off. Okay, so what we can say before we go on to the next lane in the two-way traffic is that that story of that migrant from the Philippines to Hong Kong is part of a more global set of traffic flows. We can look at one flow that goes from South and Central America north, Mexicans to the U.S. and Canada. We can look at a second flow that goes from Eastern Europe, the eastern part of the old communist bloc, to Western Europe. It's a wonderful study of Ukrainian grandmothers that migrate to Italy. Then there's the South Asia migration flow to the oil-rich Gulf. And there's North Africa, the Maghreb, going to southern Italy, southern Spain. And there's South Asia to North Asia. Those are the five main kind of migratory flows. And then there are lots of little local streams. And from the Philippines, it goes almost everywhere, so hard to draw on a map. The word in Israel for child care worker is Filipinette. So this story is not a local one. It's a global one. Now, we have workers from the global south going to the global north, but we also have clients going from the global north to the global south. Incidentally, the social class of these clients, although it's the rich north, it's not the richest people in the rich north that actually do the migrating. It's often lower middle class, and the people from the global south are not, it's poorer countries, but it's not the poorest people in those countries often people with college educations, trained nurses, tourist agents, kind of middle class, people who are migrating that way. Okay, so you have this second stream. Now, some purpose, some go for retirement. There are a million Americans who live and retire in Mexico, and that's where they live, and it's where they often die. And they are, many of the brochures that you see will advertise, you can hire a maid, you can hire a gardener, this is part of the package that you get, a cook. So there are care workers, and if you're medically, if you're ill, you have someone to take care of you. This is part of the package. But you can imagine here a 65-year-old American who has his pension cut, let's say, by GM, has two children, but the wives are working. One is a single mother, let's say. So they can't help with the care of elderly couple, and he moves to assisted living in Mexico. Make that not 65, but 85. you might have a Japanese man who's divorced, has no children, and he moves, let's say, to Burma, where in the northern Burma, the hill tribes, women are seen as very gentle and wonderful caregivers. So he'll go to Thailand, but it'll be from North Burma that the that will care for an elderly person. Or you might have a Norwegian couple that moved to southern Spain, and there's a Moroccan worker there. So again, just as we had a kind of a map for people working to, care workers going to clients, you have a kind of a map of clients coming to care workers. And if we put care front and central and emotional labor front and central, you're looking at a whole interesting kind of thing that I hope some of you graduate students really kind of roll up your sleeves and help us unpack this, learn more about this. So that's retirement, and there is also elder care. Here I'm giving some of the maps that I've just talked about for retirement migration. Well, there you go, from Japan to Burma. Okay, then there is also people go for sex tourism. And for actually, you want almost like emotional tourism. There, who is it? Aeon, it's a graduate student here who's talking about the Juice Girls in South Korea that go to Japan. No. Filipinas that go to South Korea. Okay, so that's these are girls who just offer kind of emotional connection, not just sex. And then there is medical tourism. Medical tourism, however, is a wide global movement of middle class people to medical sites. Many come to India, which has first-rate medical education. There's English is a primary language, and the cost is about a tenth what it would be elsewhere. And within India, there are specializations. If you need heart surgery, you go to Delhi, if you need a knee replacement, that's Madras. If you want Ayurvedic medicine, that's Trivandrum. There are, if you need Botox, you go to Mumbai. So they're kind of internal specialties. But one of these is a commercial surrogacy. And sorry to shock you with this image here without leading you up to it. How many people heard me the other day, yesterday? I had an extraordinary experience, research experience, a year and a half ago, of going to a small town called Anand in Gujarat, India, which has the largest center for commercial surrogates. And what it basically does, it's a clinic that receives many clients from the global north who are infertile and would like a child. And it offers to put the egg of the wife with the sperm of the husband, put them in a petri dish until they produces an embryo, which is then implanted in the surrogate. And the surrogate, for a certain amount of money, usually anything from $3,000 to $6,000, will for 9 months live in a dormitory with other surrogates and carry the child. And there are really two ways of looking at this story. One is to look at the workers as emotional workers, as women who are cast in the situation of having to manage their own feelings about the experience of carrying a child for another. And the other is to look at the economic circumstances that lead them to choose to do this. And irony is that many of the women that I talked to said, yes, this was a free choice. Since I chose to do this. But at the same time, looking at the whole situation, we would have to say that her choices, her options were imprisoned. I'll give you an example of one surrogate that I interviewed. Her name is Anjali, and she said this, that her husband was a house painter, and one day there was some lye in the paint, and he went like this with his finger that had some paint on it and was blinded, went to the doctor. The doctor said, oh, I can't do anything for you unless you can pay a certain amount of money, which she could not afford. She dashed to the money lender who has a 50% kind of interest rate, and got the money anyway. And her husband his eye was mending, but they were then destitute. She turned to relatives who, either because there were torn relationships there or because they too were very poor, couldn't help out. They lived in a hut that in the monsoon, there was a tin roof, but in the monsoon, rain would come in. Had two children. And so he had lost his job. She was worked in a shop, but for very little money. And they were stuck. And she said at her worst moment, they were kind of eyes averted, kind of going by the neighbors in shame to the temple where they could get free food twice a day. And it was at that point that she had heard that you could sell your eggs and you could work as a surrogate. And it was just when this was just getting open, because she is now the poster child for this. She's the one that doesn't have to have mask on her face. She's saying this is an industry she wants to grow. This was her experience, but at first she was so faced with shame about this because it wasn't understood by neighbors and kinspeople that this wasn't the if you were pregnant because you had an affair with somebody, this could be confused with adultery and cause for deep shame or worse. And so she moved her husband and children from the village they lived in to a village closer to this Anan, a Shankha clinic. And got pregnant, had the baby, and gave it away. And the economic side of the story is they could then move to a, they had a house built for them, they felt rich. The painter then gave up his job. He's now doing devotional music and trying to make CDs. And so he's living in Fat City. And there are two children that I saw come in with spanking new little uniforms, and their satchels in the back are in private school. Because in this town, as in the whole state, there aren't good public schools. You have to pay for education, and you have to pay for medical care. And there isn't help in getting a house. There isn't public housing. In the little village where she was, you know, there was no infrastructure. There were no roads. There were no streetlights. It was a highly individualistic, unplanned, infrastructureless place. So you get a sense of complete state plept. You're really on your own here. And under those conditions, this seemed like an extraordinary avenue of social mobility to her and to others. But what I asked her was it like to undergo this experience. And she was less forthcoming about that than others that I spoke with. But she would say, well, look, I could feel the baby kick. I could, you know, I was thinking about the baby all the time. I wanted to take good care of it. I said prayers to the baby. But I knew that I would have to give the baby up. And so I didn't really think of it as mine. And I thought, well, my clients are whiter than I am, and the baby's going to be white, and I'm dark, so it's going to be different. There's a kind of racial thing there. And Dr. Patel, the head of this clinic, told her and all the surrogates, think of your womb as a carrying case, as a bag, as something separate from you. And that way, you'll think of yourself as almost a prenatal babysitter. And it will help you efficiently kind of carry on. And I asked her, well, but how did you talk to yourself about that? And she said a number of things. Well, I tried not to think of it. When I thought of the baby, I then instantly thought about my own two children, and I thought about my house, and so she tried each time to turn her feelings away. And this was, she was not talking as if her detachment from her baby was natural, but as if she were working on it, as if she were doing a form of emotional labor allowed her to detach. And as for the client, she said, well, I didn't really get to know them very well. They came, I met them, we signed the contract, and that was like 20 minutes or half an hour, and he didn't have much to say. Where did they come from? Far away. So what are the names? I don't quite remember. Then the clients came one more time for this transfer of the ovum into the surrogate, and one third time to pick the baby up. So she didn't really have a close connection with this client family, and in the but many of the other surrogates, I didn't get this from her, but many other surrogates fantasized about a close relationship. Said, I'm imagining that she's thinking of me now and wishing me well and wondering how the baby is developing. So there was a strong desire and fantasy for a connection. And people had very different ways, even just ones I talked to, of dealing with this. I talked to another surrogate in Mumbai who had a very different story. She also came from a desperate situation. The money lender was hounding and knocking on the door in the morning. She went to get her to the clinic to become a surrogate. And she said to me, well, actually, this is my baby. And I feel it. It's my ankles that are swelling. It's my appetite that's shifting. It's not just a womb. It's a whole body. It's my breasts that are swelling. It's my dream life that's altered. It's my experience, and that's great. And she, at 7 months, they have a special ceremony to welcome the future birth. In India. And she went to the doctor and said, I'd like to have this special ceremony with the other three surrogates that were patients of the physician. And so the client, who was very involved, this was an Indian family client, they came too for the ceremony. They gave her a special sari. They had sweets. They took photographs. And so it was very different kind of experience for the second Mumbai surrogate, and she had a very close relationship with the intending couple, especially the woman. And there were visits, and she said, this is surrogate said about her client family, well, she calls me her little sister. And when the baby was born, we both pulled the baby out, and the sister and the client said, what a beautiful baby we both have. And then the client said, would you, after the baby was given over, she didn't breastfeed, and then a month later, by telephone, the client said, would you like us to bring the baby over? So you can see you can be an auntie figure in the baby's life. And the surrogate said, my doctor told me to erase the telephone number from my Rolodex because, well, I shouldn't have a close relationship with you. But, yeah, bring the baby over. And then when she saw the baby, she said, but the baby was so white and so large, didn't look like me. And I realized that I carried it for them. But and I said, well, is it a close, how do you feel about the relationship? And she said, fine, I feel wonderful about this relationship. It's just as I want. I am kind of an auntie figure to the baby. But since I, this was the other end, since I produced this baby, you know, I don't think that the client, a woman, should work. I think, you know, she should take care of it, stay home and take care of it instead of hiring a nanny. So, warm, but whoa, what are you going to do about that? So the client handled it just perfectly. She said, well, I understand how you feel, but I love the baby very much. My husband loves the baby very much, and I'm going to bring the nanny over for you to meet. So, which she did. So that's a second model for how this thing can be done. But if we're taking a relational view of this, we're looking at the economic substructure, we're looking at the imprisoned options, but we're also counting in relationships. All of this counts. Over to the right is Dr. Patel, who told Amrita Panda, who is actually UMass Amherst graduate student who did for 9 months, she was at this clinic. She is Gujarati and could speak the language and did this fabulous thing, work. She said that Dr. Patel told her, I am the largest, I have the largest collection of surrogates, and we're going to get bigger, and I'm very proud. I'm just going to make this into a city industry. And what she was doing was applying also the principle of quality control so that the surrogates were monitored and not allowed for 9 months to leave the premises of these three dormitories without being chaperoned. And that meant no sex with their husbands for 9 months as well, in case they would get infected. And she also did most of these by cesarean section because the baby was going to be better and more efficiently, I guess. Not sure what Dr. Patel's rationale for that is, but it was a fact. Anyway, she applied quality control. She wanted to increase production, and she wanted efficiency as a form of as a relational model, and that meant not ties that are not too close. These are the surrogates who are disguising their identity from neighbors and people in their life world. Here they are, sleeping in their dormitory. They get vitamin injections every day. And some of them spoke of this, you know, as a form of, again, solidarity. They could talk to each other. And they were glad to get the coconut juice and all the coconut juice and ice cream they wanted. They didn't have that with their first two pregnancies. So there were advantages to that. But you know, it's interesting. They said, they said about the first woman, Anjali, I've just told you about, others in this, in her cohort, you might say, said about her, she's too materialistic. She's wanting another pregnancy, and she wants to get more with the next one. She's going to turn herself into a machine. Now, we're giving a gift. We're doing this humanely. We haven't lost our soul. So everybody kind of seemed to draw a line. Symbolic line between the cash nexus and themselves as they symbolize themselves. And when I told stories of this to the other respondents in my study, these were middle class Americans, everybody drew a different line. Some people said, oh, surrogacy itself, no. Why not adopt? It's not a good idea. It's too much detachment. And others would say, no, surrogacy can be a very beautiful gift. Why not? But one friend to another, or a kinswoman to another. If it's somebody in your Habermasian life world, someone in your community, somebody known. And others would say, no, it doesn't have to be somebody you know. It could be a stranger, but it should be done, organized through a non-profit, as they do in England. It is legal, but it's organized not through a profit agency. And others said, no, it's fine to have commercial. It can be for money, both from the agency's point of view and from the surrogate's point of view. Why not? But not if you have baby after baby after baby. So they drew the line there. So I said, well, where? How many? Two. I talked to a cab driver who took me back and forth in Atlanta to this couple. He said, well, two. I said, well, why not three? No, two. So it's kind of this this line, you know. So wines, protective but symbolically, kind of protect us from detachment and impersonality. And that, too, is a form of emotion work. All right. Now, so there's paradox. Let me just sort of wind up here. There's a lot I could say, but what is this? What do we conclude from these two cases? Here's the baby. What do we? Oh, here's the. Okay, these are reproductive maps too. What do we conclude about this two-way traffic in emotional labor? Paradoxically, we think of the traditional family-centered South and the industrial North. But I would like to argue that the global flow north of care labor familizes the rich, brings family-like relationships, brings babies and brings caring love of the elderly and young to the rich north. And the global flow south kind of factoryizes, in a way, the poor south. So we're talking here about the emotional costs, as well as we're adding that to our financial accounting of costs from north to south. It's often said that the thing to look at is all that money that's flowing from south from north to south, and in fact, in one UN study, $356 billion, men and women everywhere are sent back in remittances, and that's three times the world's combined foreign aid, and it reaches one-tenth of the world's population. This is not trivial, the economic side of this. But to be pointed out on that economic story is that all that money back south does not develop the south. It provides food and education, but it doesn't lead to a self-sustaining economy in the south, and it doesn't do anything to inhibit forced migration of this sort. But to this economic accounting, I think we need to add a kind of an emotional accounting of what I would call backdoor foreign aid. And we usually think of foreign aid as money visibly given, publicly given. Rich countries give it to poor ones. Governments give it to government, generally man to man in a currency of money. But I think there is a backdoor foreign aid also given invisibly, privately, from poor countries to rich ones, family to family, and generally women to women in the currency